Hello and welcome to another episode of Sounds from the 70s with Gary and Rob, sometimes known as the man that kids shouldn't get into a car with. Coming to you for the last, no, not the last time, the second last time in a shack way reprieve. Out in the country past Doc Hudson's place. Now, we heard this week that the owner of this shack, who we don't know of, we've never met the owner of the shack because we do our show illegally in the shack. He found out that we were doing a show here, so he plans to burn the shack down at some point within the next 2 weeks. We don't know when, but he's trying to prevent us from relaying any more government propaganda, I guess, about his shack. I guess what we're doing is taking his shack to relay government propaganda about his shack. He's very anti-government, is what he says.
We don't know much about the fellow himself.
No, he doesn't sound very hospitable. Like, he's not a friendly guy who says, why don't you come in for a beer while you're hiking? No, he's like, why are you hiking on my property? And here's my shotgun.
Yeah, I'll kill you if I see you here again. That's what he says.
Yeah, we've never met him, but that's what people have told us out here in the country.
Once.
They you don't say once time. And you get it.
Yeah.
Okay. So we will be moving into our new digs in
2 weeks.
2 weeks. Now, that's interesting because next week's show.
Next week?
We won't be putting it up on the air. We won't be putting it up on the internet, but we will be working. Now, the reason that we're working is because Rob screwed up the schedule big time.
Oh, huge.
Big. So,
no breaks.
We've got no breaks for 3 weeks. I'm really tired as is because it even felt like the week off where we had to do a show that was just as long as the other show.
We had to, yeah, it turned out even longer.
So, I'm really tired, but we're gonna plow through after this show. We got a memorial theme to do for 3 weeks, and then we actually get a week off. So, what I'm saying is next week. There will be no new show. The week after, we still wouldn't have moved because that would be next week. No, this is way too complicated.
Yeah.
We'll tell you when we're in our new digs, okay? And when we do move into our new digs, we're going to be excited. But you know how excited we're going to be? We're going to be excited as a pig at feeding time. That's how excited we're going to be.
I mean, it's going to be nice.
It's going to be nice. There's no threat of somebody coming in here and killing us.
And the floors are paved with gold.
Well, let's just say it'll be nice. So, also, on an unrelated note, our former producer, Uptown Mike, is in deep shit, as you know, Rob.
Oh, yeah.
For telling us that he wasn't coming to band practice after the time we were supposed to have practiced.
So he did actually.
He did. He contacted me after the time that practice would have happened. That's what you call a dink move. That's when you go and you say, that guy's a dink.
Did he have a lame excuse?
Oh, he was in another city.
That's pretty lame.
But I did leave him a message a couple days before that. And he always looks at his messages, so I'm wondering why did it take him so long to return it to the point where we were ready to go to practice, and then when time ran out, we didn't go to practice.
And the truly ironic thing is, he's the one who called for a practice tonight.
He did.
Yes.
Isn't he a dink?
He's something else.
So two nays for Uptown Mike. this week's show... Oh, my thing's not working. Here we go. This week's show is an all-Beatles show.
All Beatles.
As we finish our look at the Beatles in the year 1973 by reviewing an album not released in 1973, just to throw people off.
This is one we missed back in the year 2000.
This is Ringo Starr's 1970 country album, Beaucoup à Blue. Or as pronounced in English, it's pronounced, that's a lot of blues, I tell ya. Actually, it does.
I was pronouncing it beaucoup blues.
Actually, it actually does. If you look at it, it says in the English translation, a lot of blues. It does.
A lot of. See, I've only heard this word knowingly once before, and all I'll say about it is I thought it was a Vietnamese word.
Oh, like buku nai pam.
Too buku. Too buku.
Oh, yeah, too much. Too much.
Yeah, too much.
Yeah, that's what it means, yeah.
That's the only time I've heard it. I, like I said, I didn't realize it. It's too French, much blues. But now it makes sense.
Okay, shut the fuck up. yeah, we're not doing the Ringo album released in 1973, as I've mentioned many times in the last 4 weeks, because we reviewed it already. So go back and listen to it, and you'll get a good capsule of all four albums that were released. There's actually, well, I'll get to that in a second. But that's why we're doing Buku a Blue.
Buku a Blues.
Yes. We also, in a minute, like I said, we'll be talking about some more Beatle tidbits. But first, speaking of giving me a lot of blues, Rob, how was your week?
My week was a groovy experience through time. I was on a desert island, but not on a desert island. I looked at the world through a glass pane, a window glass pane. I was separate, but I could see what was going on.
Speaking of glass pane, I just had to go through the pain of listening to that.
You did, while you were drinking. How could you continue to drink while listening to that?
You know what? I still had to take a drink, and I had to end it. I had to end it. I was not through drinking, and it was like, okay, I can't do this to my audience. I love my audience.
It's my job to make your one pause during the show to drink unsatisfying.
I'm getting awfully blue. See,
you're that thing getting close to the microphone.
I think I'm getting close to the microphone. That's good, because then I'm loud and then you're not. You can turn me down if you
want. Am I up there? I'm not up there.
You can turn me down. I'm going to be like, I don't know.
Maybe you got bumped during...
Yeah, I got the bumps during our...
You got bumped. I'm turning you way down.
He's turning me down, and I was the one who pointed out that my waves were getting all high blue. Have you ever, by the way, people, have you ever had your waves all high blue? Okay, that's much better. So this episode, we are ending our Beatles theme for this year.
Oh, yeah.
Bye-bye.
So long, Beatles. No more for you until next year.
Until next year, yeah. And we're going to be relating a couple of stories for you that we wanted to get to, but I always said we'll get it to next week. Well, next week is the time.
This is next week.
It's relating, it's stories that give more of an overview of the year in Beatle, 1973. I like that. The year in Beatle. 1973.
Not to be confused with the Volkswagen car.
Now, let's start with the ugly. No, this is a funny story, actually. And this is a story I wanted to tell you for a couple weeks. But every time I mention the name of this album, Rob goes berserk.
Oh, it makes me angry.
But this is a sometime in New York City story. Rob doesn't like that. I'm trying to think of the Abbott and Costello skit, but I can never think of the title. Susquehanna Hat Company.
Susquehanna.
Every time. Don't you mention the Susquehanna Hat Company. the story I had, and I love this story, and this is a true story. I don't tell fake musical stories. But last year, which was the 50th anniversary of Sometime in New York City, and if any of you, to divert for a second, if any of you are big John Lennon fans, as I am, as most of the world is, you realize that there was a John Lennon Plastic Ono Band big box set, like 6 CDs and a DVD and whatever, that got accolades. And then they released an Imagine box set, again, like 6 CDs and a DVD and a whole bunch of stuff that, again, got accolades. And then they decided, okay, well, it's 1972. It's the 50th anniversary. Let's do a Sometime in New York City box set. So they got everything ready, you know, they remastered the tracks, and they got, you know, all the liner notes written and...
everything ready.
Just basically everything almost ready to the point of printing it all up. And then somebody with a logical mind said... This is not a good idea. And they put the kibosh on the Sometime in New York City album, to which most of John Lennon's fans went, whew. We dodged.
We don't have to get that one.
And now I found that when I read that story, I just thought, first of all, why the hell are you planning a box set around one of the worst albums I've ever heard? Like, well, people plan box sets sometimes around every album. Like, Paul McCartney is doing that. Paul McCartney has been having his box sets since 2012, maybe 2010. I don't know.
Has he had a box set celebrate a box set yet?
Oh, shut up.
It's what I would do.
And he has concentrated on almost every album. And then he was starting to get into some pretty iffy albums. And he hasn't had one for a couple of years. So we don't know what the status of that is. Because he was going to do, like, I don't know, at least every album up to like 1989 or something. Not 1989, up to like the mid-90s. And I think he just, it's in limbo right now. But then I was thinking, man, I love Paul, but there's a couple of real duds. Is he going to make like a 4-CD box set out of that crap? I always wonder when artists do that, like, really? That's a terrible album. You're going to do a huge box set on that?
Maybe if you get all the terrible albums into one box set.
Yes.
That's what I'd do.
I can't tell any stories without Rob having a bad anecdote.
I must interject badly.
You might interject greatly here. You wanted to express your opinion, and I'm giving you room here in the script to talk about, you wanted to say sometime in New York City, but on a Yoko point of view.
Yeah, we never discussed Yoko during that
show.
Yeah,
Rob had pointed this out last week to me that he wanted to say something about that, even though we did a whole show on sometime in New York City.
And then we run late and got to the end and...
Then I got to drive him home and all that bullshit.
Forgot. Yeah. Totally forgot.
What did you want to get off your chest?
I want to say, Yoko Ono, keep on doing what you're doing.
That's not what you wanted to say.
It kind of is.
Really?
Well, Yoko Ono decided to approach art from the avant-garde point of view, the I'm not going to be like the other kids point of view. And she approached music the same way.
Okay, you know what bugs me about, and this has nothing to do with Yoko, because I appreciate Yoko as the artist. I actually, and I'm not really going to get into this, but I've heard things.
Things.
And I'm not a real big fan of Yoko as a person. I've heard things. I've been in this business a long time, and I've heard things. But I actually do like her craft. I actually like the things that she does. And I got sidetracked for a second there because the door went open.
Oh, the shack is falling apart.
What was I talking about? Yoko, there was something I went. Oh, just yesterday, there's so many kismet things happening with this fucking show. It's incredible. But just yesterday, a magazine put up the best solo albums from worst to best of the Beatles. Studio albums. Of course, not including live albums and not including greatest hits packages.
Okay, yeah.
And it was a bullshit list. I'll tell you that because I'm not going to say anything about the list because I found it to be bullshit. Although, not surprisingly, as I find out with almost every list that I've come across in the last 5 years or so, All Things Must Pass always comes in first. Which surprises some people. It doesn't surprise me. I did not vote this the best album. I think Rob did.
No, I didn't. I was Paul McCartney as well.
Oh, we were. Yeah.
We were both. Yeah,
we were both. Yeah, I have no qualms about that. Like, I have no second reservations. I know that in my heart as a fact that that's the best. And anyways, not talking about that. Everybody else always says All Things Must Pass, and I'm just making that as a note. I'm not criticizing it or anything. I'm just saying. So many people agree with that. It's kind of interesting.
If it were just the first two albums on All Things Must Pass, I think you'd have a real contender there. But
we're not going to get into that. But I have a contention because I have a contention with the jam side. Nobody considers the jam side. But I'm sorry, it's part of the album package. And it I do have a conjection, a beef with the production of The Wall of Sound by Phil Spector. I wish the album was just the songs, because it probably is, but close to the best solo Beatle album, But I can't really tell what that production it is. Even when I was a kid and I heard it, when I was like 12 years old or 13 years old, and my brother brought it home, even the production then bothered me. And it has just bothered me. Not on every song, and we've discussed this before, but just on some of the songs, it benefits greatly. But I'll never forget the time a year or two ago when I was driving in my car and I heard What Is Life, and it just sounded so from another planet with this production from 50 years ago with Phil Spector. And it just, I mean, out of this world is it not good? Like, it just didn't belong. And it's too bad because it's a fantastic song with a great riff and it's a great song. And I just thought if it was left to be the bare bones, it would have been fantastic. But anyways, not getting into that. What bugged me about this list, other than some really atrocious picks, for like worst and all that. It's just atrocious picks. They were going more by chart position than they were by actual quality.
Than actual listening. I don't think they actually listened.
But what they did was that they only had 5 John Lennon albums on there because they did not count any albums that John did with Yoko.
Okay.
So Sometime in New York City was not on there. Double Fantasy was not on there.
Linda, was that the...
See, and there's my contention. Okay, so they only had 5 John Lennon albums. They had the Plastic Ono Band album, Imagine.
They had Wings there, didn't they?
Quiet. I'm getting to that. Well, They had Mind Games. They had Walls and Bridges. And they had the Rock and Roll album. They had 5 albums on there, whereas Ringo had like 30. And it made Ringo look really bad because he's got 30 albums, and Ringo being Ringo, he had all these albums listed right at the back because he's released a lot and he's lived a long time, and he's lived twice as long as John. So I said, this is such a bullshit, even discriminatory list. And these albums, now they're not solo albums because Yoko was on it. And then I thought, just like you said, yeah. Hey, Ram
Paul and Linda there.
It's Paul and Linda's album. It is actually credited. That's the word I was looking for. Yes. The album is credited to Paul and Linda McCartney. Why is that? What about the Wings album? That doesn't have any Wings album, because even the first one and some of the first one, Wildlife, doesn't Wings even have Paul's name in it.
The Plastic Ono Band doesn't.
No, Plastic. See, that's.
Or does it?
The Plastic Ono Band, I guess, does, because they were just the backup band.
Oh, okay.
So it was John Lennon and the... You see, that's where it gets sticky, because I shouldn't even get into this, because it's not even worth my time, because it's such bullshit. But there are actually albums called Wings, right? Like Wildlife. Yes. That shouldn't qualify, because he's part of a band. It's not a solo album. Technically, it's not a solo album. And then you go into albums like Wings at the Speed of Sound, where other people sing songs that they wrote. That's technically not a Paul McCartney solo. No. That's a group album.
Wings is exactly a band. It's just like Paul said. Wings is not Paul McCartney's backup.
Which is fine. A band. If you're going to include all of Paul's stuff, then you got to include all of John's stuff with Yoko. It's a very flawed way of thinking it all around about the whole thing. And it just pissed me off. And there we go. I had to bring that up because it really pissed me off, because it's so unfair to say, John Lennon had all these great albums, because he only released 5, according to us.
Sorry, I didn't catch the name of this rotten publication.
I forget. I just saw it yesterday, and I was going to remember it, but then I decided it's not worth remembering.
You were so angry, you couldn't write down the name.
No, I didn't want to give him credit. I didn't want to give him credit, so I just said, I'm not going to write it down. Forget it.
Hey, when I purchase a bad product, I make sure everybody knows the name of that product.
I do. There is a good list out there by the Ultimate Classic Rock website that I read many years ago that actually does the same thing. And I will bring that in next week. We're going to continue. Not next week, but next week. The next
sometime
week.
Sometime in the future when we do the Beatles again.
No.
No.
You know, longer in the future? I might bring it
maybe
in.
Maybe next week. We don't know.
Yeah, I'll bring it in for next week, and we'll do a segment on it, and then get the Beatles stuff out of the way. But because when we do next year, we're going to talk all about 1974, and it won't matter. I still have to talk about these other two things that I wanted to talk about. One was, see, I got really...
Really sidetracked.
Really sidetracked.
Yes, sir.
That wasn't even in the script.
That is our talent.
That wasn't even in the script. When I was listening on the George's Living in the Material World album, I gave a really good listen. And I've heard this song many times since I was a kid, but I gave a really good listen to the Bangladesh single, which is one of the bonus tracks on it. And as I'm listening to it, by the way, really good song. And then I was thinking, this is word for word, could have been used as a We Are the World single at the time of the Ethiopian, and it would have been like, this is a pretty serious, cool song. I consider We Are the World to be one of the worst pieces of shits I've ever heard. It's a terrible song.
It's not a good song.
It's not. People will agree that at the very least, it's not a good song. And at the very most, it may be one of the worst songs ever written. And I was listening to these great lyrics on Bangladesh. And I was like, that's a fantastic song about starvation and about helping people, and it's not saccharine and it's not sentimental and it's not even what you'd call going to the lowest common denominator to get your
appealing to the
and all you would have to do as I was listening to the song and reading the words was change the name of Bangladesh to like Africa or Pakistan
wherever they're starving.
Yeah, well, we don't want to get rude, but not Pakistan, Ethiopia. That's not nice, Rob. I'm sorry.
It keeps happening over and over again.
It does, people. But you know what? We're not there, so we can't really criticize what's going on.
I'm not criticizing. And
I'm just saying we shouldn't even talk about it because we don't know how to live there or what it's like. And I know what happens over and over. I get your point, but let's not go into that. Don't get mad at me.
I'm not. I have a great indifference to this sort of thing.
Okay. I'm just saying that it would have been such a... To have a meaty single like that, like Bangladesh was, and then you release that for We Are the World. That's the kind of song you want. Like, I was going like, fuck, that's a perfect song for the African...
Well thought out and sincere. I got the impression...
Sincere,
that
yeah.
We Are the World was a knee-jerk reaction.
And we got to write a song, and as a... you know...
Oh, yeah. We're going to talk about bad songwriting later in the show.
Later in the show. So I just wanted to say that. I also wanted to wrap this up for 1973 with the Beatles before we get to Ringo. And first of all, what a fantastic year. See, we didn't live through any of the peak solo Beatle years. By the time John Lennon was already dead by the time Rob started listening to seriously to music. Yeah. But I started listening in 1977, and John Lennon was in semi-retirement, so he wasn't releasing any albums. Paul was. George was only releasing now albums every 3 years. And Ringo was releasing... So there was the big flourish that happened at the beginning of the 70s, where there were separate singles every year, and there was at least four albums. Must have been a glorious time to be a Beatle fan. So 1973 had to be one of the best years in all of Beatle years. And I'll tell you why. You had the four albums... They actually released five albums technically this year, the solo Beatles. You had a Red Rose Speedway, very good album.
Okay, yeah.
You had Mind Games, a good album. Not great, but a good album. You also had George's Living in the Material World, I think an excellent album. And then at the end of the year, you had Ringo Starr's Ringo album, which I think is one of the best solo Beatles albums ever. Anybody who wants to contend with me on that can fight me in the
Real
street.
Fight.
Yeah, because it is. And then you had singles. You had Paul released separately singles, Hi, 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 Sea Moon. Of course, he had on the Red Wolf Speedway, My Love, which went to number one. Live and Let Die, another separate single from the James Bond film. From John, All You Had Was Mind Games, but what a powerful single. From George, All You Had Was Give Me Love, Give Me Peace on Earth, but then went to number one, powerful single. Like, these, it's like they're just trading off, and it's like the whole year is Beatles. And then with Ringo at the end, I never count Band on the Run, because it was released like in the last 2 weeks of 1973. So it didn't really start to affect people till 1974.
It kind of sort of counts,
but I never consider it. And we could have included it anyways, because we already reviewed it, obviously, because we said earlier that we feel that it's the best solo Beatle album ever. So you had Band on the Run at the end of the year, and then you had Ringo with Photograph, and Oh My My, and Year 16 as singles. What an amazing Beatle year. And yet it didn't end, because you had your first Beatle compilations album. You had the Red Album released in the middle of the year, 1962 to 1966.
That was those ones where they were all looking down that square staircase.
I bought that album.
The blue one and the red one.
I bought that album in 1978 when I was 12 years old. It wasn't one of the first Beatles, because I spent a lot, and I could have been 1977. I don't know. But it was my introduction to, like, the early Beatles was 1966. I still got that album that I bought in late 1977. And then there was the Blue Album, released on the same day, 1967, 1970. They both went right up the charts and made people buy Beatle albums like they were like a brand new Beatle album. And they went through the roof. I never bought the 1967-70 albums because I kind of had everything, or was going to have everything.
I think I had that one, and I didn't have the early one.
The red one, yeah. And I listened to the red one all the time.
I remember getting, my brother got the Beatles' Real Music, which was all the stuff
early
the,
80s, yeah.
From all the movies they had done.
That was a good one.
Speaking of which, I got to see Yellow Submarine one these days.
You always say that.
I'm gonna.
You never do.
I'm gonna.
Before I die. It was just a fabulous year. A couple of fabulous years in Beatledom were 1970, when they all released solo albums. Ringo released two, and we're reviewing one today. And of course you had Plastic Ono Band album, and then you had All Things Must Pass. What a year, holy fuck. And then you had Paul's album, McCartney, his first solo album. And on top of that, you had their final album, Let It Be. So you had a plethora of albums in 1970. You had a plethora of albums in 1973. The only other year I can think of, 1974 was also a big year. Things started to dive off a little bit. They had that initial flurry, and then, you know, as the music industry changed too, you didn't have to release albums every year.
Yeah.
And if you're a Beatle, you don't have to do anything you don't want to do anyway.
Plus, that's the stage, you know, you got families and...
Yeah, which John did, and Paul. Paul, amazingly, with his growing family, still released albums, but they didn't have the pressure of touring all the time. In fact, Paul basically didn't tour until his Wings Over the World or Wings Over America tour in 1975-76. He just toured universities in England in 1973, so he just had that one tour in the 70s. It was a big tour, but he just had one. And George had that one small tour in 1974, which was about a month and a half in the States. Other than that, all they had to do was write songs and record albums, which is nice. And nobody ever asked you going to tour, because they just assumed that they wouldn't, which is nice too. They get no pressure.
Pressure's
to tour.
Off. Yeah. We can do anything we want now.
So that was the year 1973, one of the biggest Beatle years ever, as far as both quality and quantity is concerned. I didn't even know. Like, I just go through Beatle years and I never add it all up. But since we did this, I have added it all up, and I'm going like, wow. What a time to be a Beatle fan. Like, and John said it. John got one of those questions again. When are the Beatles going to get back together? And he says, why do people complain? You get four albums every year. You get a whole bunch of singles. If you really want a Beatle album, take three off of Paul's, take three off of George's, take three off of mine, and take three off of Ringo's. and you got your own Beatle album, because they'd be that's what I'd be writing anyways, you know. And it was a good point.
No. Take most of them from John and Paul, and two from George.
Yeah, that's actually why we broke up. That is actually, as we just found out in the last year or two, why they broke up was especially Paul's indignant attitude towards George's songwriting. They probably would have made another album, at least one more album, if not both, or if not a couple, if John and Paul weren't so stingy about letting Ringo, or they'd always liked Ringo to have a song on the album. It's like, oh, it'd be real funny to have Ringo have a song on the album. But when George wanted to have one, it was like, I don't think so. Well, maybe one. And yet all the best songs on the later albums were all George's.
All his were like a hits. He only put hit songs on the album. Yeah. Well, not only, but still, most of them.
He was and half the and greatest half. Albums, like the White Album and Abbey Road, and even Revolver with Taxman and all that. And it's like, your songs are not very good, man. Oh, really?
Sinatra disagrees.
Frank Sinatra said it was the greatest love song ever written. And then I also had Here Comes the Sun on the same album. Holy smokes. Isn't that a coincidence?
A coinkydink. Telling us some years ago, one of my music instructors in college, when he graduated, the conducting test he had to do was to the song Here Comes the Sun, which has about four or five different timings in it.
I know. I will never try and play that song because it's just way too complicated. George is a songwriter and George is a guitar player. I'm not going to get into that. That's another topic. I talked about this before when we talked about one of his, might have been All Things Must Pass, but he should have played more guitar, as in non-slide. He played every solo ever since he learned how to play slide guitar from Delaney Bramlett on the Delaney and Bonnie tour. I listened on every album. He played every solo with the slide. And he plays great slide. You know, you've heard My Sweet Lord. It's great, but it has a cheery feel. And there are some songs that need that kind of dark George Harrison solo, you know, that's a little bit more gritty. And it never happened again. He never used anything but a slide solo for every solo he did until he passed away. And I think that's a shame. You think that I'm knocking his slide, but I'm not, because anybody can tell a George Harrison slide part when they hear it, but you don't have to use it for every single song. That's my only complaint.
Yeah, he was still great when he played without the slide.
Oh, I know. The Let It Be solo, both of them are good, but the one that's rocking on the album is one of the greatest solos ever. It's one of the greatest solos ever. And he never did anything like that rough and just a plain solo. Or the middle. One of the best and most beautiful solos is the one in the middle of Something. The solo in there. And it's so heartfelt. And even the beginning, like that part. But the solo in there is just beautiful. But you don't get that when you're playing slide. You can't bend the strings and get the emotion when you're on slide all the time. And that's one thing that I don't... But, you know, the thing about George, which I like, is he doesn't care. He said, if I want to play slide, I'll play slide. That's what I like about George. He didn't talk about out of shit because, you know, what do I care if I, you know, I want to do it, so I do it. So now we go and...
jump straight into the album.
Go straight into the album. Go straight into the Ringo world, as they say. Have you went straight into the Ringo world?
No, I've gone to the Bonzo world.
Bonzo, yeah, you and John Bonham used to hang out all the time.
We used to play Monopoly and Scrabble.
Yeah, crazy fuckers. So today we are reviewing the 1970 country album from Ringo Starr called Beaucoup et Bleu.
Didn't he steal that from George Harrison?
Beaucoup.
Oh no, that was For You Blue.
I always thought, by the way, it has a neat cover, because if you ever look at the cover, it's a really nice cover. It's a cover of Ringo on a porch in Nashville, but they make everything tinted blue. And I just kind of noticed this. I always thought, why is this cover so good? Because they have the title in blue, Beaucoup a Blues, and then they tinted the photograph so it's all the same shade of blue also. And that's why those little subtle tricks that your mind, that your conscious mind doesn't pick up on, but your subconscious does. And it's like, that's why it's such an attractive cover, is because of the the pastoral type of blue that they put over it. And the kind of pose that Ringo gives, a very contemplative kind of bluesy, I'm feeling the blues type of pose, is exactly what I'm talking about conveying what the album is about by the album cover. And the songs are mostly very downbeat country blues songs, which were songs that Ringo would always... This was his forte, because he always used to request them when he was playing in Hamburg with Rory Storm and the Hurricanes. And when the Beatles played, he'd always want slow blues songs, really sad, you know, late at night, 2 o'clock when they were playing. And this reminds me of that. This reminds me of these are the type of songs that he liked to hear. I don't know if Rob... I can tell Rob doesn't like this album as much as I do. I can kind of tell it.
There's some things that I don't know if I got past.
You know what?
What?
This is your week to review first.
Perhaps it is.
It is. In fact, last week was your opportunity to review first, but I took that away from you too. I've done it for 170 shows last week and this week. Hey, I've done 170 plus shows doing it first. It's a habit, so you got to tell me.
I know. You just kind of goes into it then.
I am though glad that I did the George Harrison one first. Because I had a lot of deep things I wanted to say. See, sometimes, like, the Ringo album you can go with, but there are some things that I wanted, that I had to say about George Harrison before we talked about the music and stuff. And I don't think I have too much to say about this before you start, other than Ringo had released an album in early 1970, just as the Beatles were breaking up, just before they broke up. He did an album of standards for his mum, as he said, so his mum would like it. And then he did this album at the end of 1970, which was, again, country music was... Oh, I got a great story. I got to tell this story. The reason this album came to be is because George Harrison had hired the Nashville steel guitar player Pete Drake to play on All Things Must Pass. So George sent him a plane ticket out to London. And he said, George said to Ringo, could you pick up, you know, Pete Drake from the airport and bring him into London and you know, get him set up? And he said, sure. So he went out in his car and picked him up. And Pete Drake looked around Ringo's car as they were driving into London. And he goes, wow, all your tapes, I would imagine they're 8-track tapes and stuff, all country albums. And he said, you must like country. And he says, I love it. And I love it. I can't do the Liverpoolian accent, but he goes, I love it.
I love it.
That's all I could listen to if I had to. And right then, Pete Drake said, well, man, why don't I arrange a session and produce it for you? And you come first. Ringo wanted to do it in London. And then Pete Drake, well, I can set up all the musicians, the Nashville Cats, the greatest.
If you're going to do the country blues, where are you going to? Well, you might find some talented guys in London, but none who really specialize in country
blues. There's the greatest session musicians in the world. There's the Wrecking Crew in Los Angeles, of course. There's the Muscle Shoals bands, Booker T and the MGs, whatever, in Georgia and Tennessee and the whole South that they cover. I'm probably missing somebody, but just off the top of my head, then there's the Nashville Cats. And the Nashville Cats, man, it's hard to compare any one of those session musicians, because they're all legendary in their own right. But the Nashville Cats, they kind of, like you mentioned them, they go, because they can, like, you give them something. And they'll say you got like a half an hour to do it. They'll get it done in half an hour.
They're recording a song an hour here, is what I was.
Yeah, I mean they're just amazing. They know what to do because they're working in the country genre. They can't express themselves or add too much stuff because it's not a it's not a musical type of I want a real hip type of thing there. It basically has to stick to structure, so they know exactly like how to make the song sound country. But they're also talented enough to stretch out, as you hear kind of at the end of the album, that we're not supposed to hear the bonus track or the Nashville Jam, which they just cook on, which they're never allowed to do First, with artists.
I thought that was the closing of the album.
See? You got to know where the bonus tracks are. Coochie Coo. But they never get to do that because when like a George Jones walks in, it's like they do their five songs and you get it exactly right. And then the session's over, right? Or anybody that comes in. So Ringo was like kind of like that. But then he was like, why don't we jam at the end? We're all done. Let's work on some fun stuff. And they must have enjoyed that. They enjoyed having Ringo there big time for even though he's only there for 3 days. I mean, it's a nice breath of a fresh air. And anyways, that's all I have to say about the background of the album, except, I just got to add this, after this album was released and the Sentimental Journey album was released, which both didn't do very well.
I can see this one kind of not doing very well because...
On the charts. It didn't sell very well, but Bukuza Blues got a lot of very good reviews. Not great reviews. You have to take a Ringo album in context, right? But it got really good reviews. Even John said in his Rolling Stone interview, he said when they asked, Jan Wenner was asking about all the Beatles solo albums, and he said, oh, George is okay, not my kind of thing. Like, he didn't like any of them. He said Paul's was junk, and he said that Ringo's was good. He said, I like Ringo's. It's not as embarrassing as his first one. Which is funny. But that was kind of what everybody was thinking. Hey, this is a good album. It's Ringo. It's Ringo, and he's kind of doing his thing. But he was so put off, I think, by the albums not selling, that he turned strictly to singles and to acting for the next 3 years until the Ringo album, which we've already reviewed. And we will review the Sentimental Journey album at some time in the future. A couple of years, I don't know.
The first year.
1975, actually. So in 2 years, if you can wait, we'll be reviewing the Sentimental Journey album. So... that takes us up to now, and we're going to review the album. And reviewing the album today is going to be a man we call Robert, or the person you wouldn't want to get into a car with alone.
Shuggy.
No, not Shuggy.
I'm not Shuggy tonight? Ah, damn you.
You're the man who you not want to get into a car with alone.
Well, that's every night. I got some things to say about this album. Had some good points and had some bad points. First thing was, on the first listen, the first couple of listens, I was thinking, you know, his vocals aren't as strong as they could be. But upon further listens...
Oh, shit. Really?
Sorry. I'll let you go. You
no,
go right
I'm
ahead.
Sorry. That was rude. That was actually... Because he never interrupts me. And I heard a joke and I just had to put that in and I apologize.
I'm sure there'll be more. Actually, his singing was not bad on a whole bunch of it. There was a couple points where you definitely notice his voice is weak. And when he has to finish a line and has a long word or a word that has to be emphasized quite a bit, it sounds like he runs out of breath. But for most of the rest of it, I really liked his vocals. He's Ringo. Yeah. He was singing as Ringo.
That's what everybody, you know, that's so funny. That's what everybody says when they review an album. They say, you know, and it doesn't matter what album, it could be the first album or his 30th. They always say, I had a little bit of trouble with the vocals, but then it's Ringo, so it's okay.
Yes. Ringo is comfortable because we know him from the Beatles.
Yes.
We hear Ringo and we think Beatles. But the other thing with his vocals, in some of the songs when he was doing the fade-outs, would he improvise over the fade-outs? I thought he did that poorly. But it did. I got the mental picture of like your uncle singing at a wedding or something.
And I kind of like my uncle when he sings at a wedding. So
my real comparison there, my real thing, which
I am that uncle who sings at the weddings.
Boo 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 boo, la 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 la.
Oh man,
I'm gonna kill you before this show's over.
Oh, that's me. Hey, are you cool cats and chicks?
The real thing I got to thinking, okay, if I'm putting together a band and I'm auditioning for lead vocals and two guys show up, one of them is Ringo, one of them is Telly Savalas, who do I pick?
This is really good. I've got to get you to start more often. Because I'm super serious, but you're actually making your points in a very offhanded way, and I kind of like it.
When you start, it's like when you get to a point that I have some thoughts on, I usually interject then, and so it doesn't get a chance there. But
tell me some hours. So this is what I got. I got Ringo in the one room. And I tell you, Tally also, he just dropped by out of race in the other. I don't know what to do.
Hey, they both auditioned, and let me tell you, Tally, he was belting them out.
He was just knocking him out of the park.
I'm thinking he's got the presence we need for this job. Ringo, I'm sorry. You're good. We like you. No, hell, we love you.
Oh, man. This is, if this was Rob's show, this is what it would be like, okay?
But it will never be my show. For I refuse to accept the responsibility, for I have too much responsibility elsewhere in life.
Like sleeping.
You know, I did like... some of the instrumentalists there. Especially, what was the song? Don't tell me, the $15 draw. I was listening to that one and when the guitar picking came in.
Jerry Reed.
Yes. I didn't know who it was at the time, but I said, whoever this cat is, he's good. Now I have to find out who played on the album. And I'm reading the credits, and the other guy playing guitar there that I recognize is Charlie Daniels. So without knowing which one it wasn't until I got to the lyrics. And as soon as they say, when you're hot, you're hot.
I have to say something about this, okay? I have to say something about this, because this is weird. And not being there at the time... in that culture, I can't say specifically what's going on, but this is interesting. I heard that. I've heard this album before, and I've totally kind of ignored that, right? But then when you're reviewing it, you take a much more critical ear and kind of listen for everything, as you know. So at the end of $15 Draw, which, by the way, is a fantastic song because Jerry Reed is one of the great... Again, all these country players are not recognized as some of the great... We talked about this last week or the week before that about how the great country players are some of the... Country guitarists are some of the greatest rock... Not rock and roll. Guitar players of all time. Glenn Campbell, Roy Clark, Jerry Reed. They can play better than like maybe even Jimmy Page or Jeff Beck. But they're not made, they don't have a form of music that does that.
Yeah, I mean, the country music fans, they got these guys. But whereas, you know, we worship Clapton as God, and they don't worship their guitarists.
Because they don't get, but Clapton did that when he did country. He hardly soloed at all. When he's, you know, he did the album's backlist. Yeah. Like, he hardly played lead guitar. It's not a medium that needs lead guitar, especially... The kind of flashy lead guitar.
How do these guys get this good?
I know, but they are amazing. Anyways, at the end of this incredible song and this incredible end, by the way, Jerry Reed plays almost all of his solos that I've recognized on the acoustic guitar, which just flabbergasts me also.
It's just like,
he just makes it, he makes the acoustic guitar rock.
The fact that he was picking an acoustic like that, it's just, okay, wait a second.
He's done that with all the Elvis songs I've heard him play on. He's played on about 3 Elvis songs, and he just plays the shit out of these songs on the acoustic guitar. Fuck, man. Anyways, you were talking about the end of the song, a $15 draw.
Yeah, when he says, when you're hot, you're hot. That's how I knew it was him.
Now, it's interesting. And again, I don't know. Sorry. I don't know. This album was recorded in June of 1970. The huge single by Jerry Reed, When You're Hot, was not even released until April of 1971. I check this. So I want to know what the hell happened. Like, how did the song that wasn't even recorded yet, because I also checked the recording,
mentioned on
and it wasn't recorded yet, and yet he is talking as if that's Jerry Reed, the guy who wrote When You're Hot, You're Hot. And I'm going, what the fuck is going on here? Like, seriously, it's a Twilight Zone thing. I'm saying, how does he know in the middle of 1970 about how big this song is from Jerry Reed that hasn't even been recorded.
I bet you it was a catchphrase Jerry Reed used all the time for everything.
I'm still looking into this because, seriously, is this a time travel thing? maybe somebody released a song before that, but I'm seriously, I'm being dead serious. Like, how did he know that when you're hot, the song hasn't even been recorded yet? And I'm going to look that up for you people.
We're going to email Ringo, ask him. Do you remember that Simpsons episode where he was answering all his mail and finally got to Marge's letter? Yeah, I don't expect he'll get our email.
By the way, he doesn't read mail anymore. He made a video about that. About he doesn't read mail. Anyways, I had to bring that up because it still freaks me out. I will get the answer. Go ahead, Rob.
That was weird. The instrumentalist, I rather enjoyed that. But, the, you know, here's the thing. The songwriting, that bugged me a bit in that I found it to be really in a box, really stock. This is a style of music that Ringo likes. I don't. I genuinely don't.
Ringo, I gotta disagree with you on your lake of country music.
I wanted to say that the backing tracks, the backing music, felt lackluster, but it didn't feel lackluster.
Now, I think a point we should make here is that this is not country rock.
No.
This is country.
No, there's only a few songs that actually pick up the tempo a bit.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. You're right. There's only like two songs, like $15 Draw being one of them. What was the other which one even there? Have
Loser's Lounge
and Loser's ones. Lounge, which have any sort of up-temponess to them. And I would assume Ringo wanted that. I would assume yes. that he was saying, I like this blues, this slow country blues.
The sad country, slow blues.
I'm at the bar drinking blues. And so to anybody who's thinking, is this a country rock record like Act Naturally or something like that, one of those songs? It's not. It's actually a pretty old time.
Yeah.
It's not one of those Kris Kristofferson. We reviewed his album. I can't remember now. Kris Kristofferson, the new guys on the block, songwriters. This is not the new wave of country music. This is a kind of an old wave country album. And I think people should know that.
It's old country. It's definitely not country. The new country. Yeah. But, like I say, I find it to be very... these guys sound like songwriters who've written 1,000 songs each, and they're a little hard-pressed for new ideas and new material, new ways of saying things. So the songwriting kind of turned me off a bit like that. And like I was saying, you know, with the musicians going in and doing a song in like a half an hour, an hour, they... chunk out really good solid parts, but they cannot add any imagination in that time.
I don't.
And I wouldn't expect.
I agree
them to,
with that. I
wouldn't
but I don't expect think they're expected. To. Yeah, I don't think that's what I was going to say. I don't think they're expected.
That's just it. That's the style that this music requires. And like I say, I wanted to say to me it felt lackluster, but it didn't. It sounded lackluster.
Okay.
It lacked a luster to me. It didn't shine.
There was a luster, but there was it was murky luster.
You could tell the playing was good, but it was so limited and had to be this way. Is not coochie, my style of music.
Coochie.
I only listened to it the one time because the next few listens I didn't listen to the bonus tracks. But yeah, when you die and go to hell, you'll be playing jazz. When I die and go to hell, I'll be playing like this.
Why do you think why do you think, first of all, that I hate jazz? I actually do. It's just that my jazz is very limited to what I like.
You're going
to
be playing the jazz that you don't like.
Okay, good point.
And I'll be playing the country that I don't like.
Because the only reason I took offense with that is because he doesn't like jazz even more than I do.
No, but on the car, Thursday nights when you got to drive here and they're playing jazz... It's usually the kind of jazz which is unpleasurable for you to listen to.
Yes, it's not the jazz I pick out. right? Yeah. It's the jazz that has played for me. And I admit, I only like about 20% worth of jazz. But the 20% worth of jazz that I like, almost every Miles Davis record, and we'll get to that when we review other jazz albums, is some of the greatest records I've ever heard. But it's very limited.
Yes.
And I do have trouble with old-time country music also. I do have trouble, not specifically with this, but I do have trouble with the saccharine country of that time, that Kris Kristofferson, and I can't remember his name. Specifically
plays on the emotions.
The new wave of, why can't it? We reviewed his album and I can't remember his name.
I'm going to find out here.
This was what they were rebelling against, and I don't like the strings. There's not strings in here, but that's the country music I don't like. It's more pop than country. I don't mind this, actually.
That over, but it is still old overproduced
country. Yeah, I agree with you on that. Although I don't agree with you that it's the country that I dislike. The country that I dislike is like Eddie Arnold and stuff like that. That's very smooth and you almost doze off while you're listening to it because it's got strings and there's almost no drum. I don't think there is any drums. It's just all schmaltz. And but this is hardcore country. This is not. There's not rock involved in this. And that's why, and I know that's why you don't like it, and I understand.
Well, another thing was lyrically, I was listening to the singing, and I didn't mind it too much until I read the lyrics. And then, like I say, the lyrics, there's a few songs I kind of like. Like $15 Draw, Silent Homecoming I kind of liked. On the first side, Women of the Night I liked, or Woman of the Night. But for the most part, a lot of the lyrics... it's like too much of the same thing.
I understand.
I could dig on a bunch of these songs if there was a bit more balance. But this
that's what you get when you listen to jazz. Also, if you're not a jazz listener, a lot of it sounds the same. Same with reggae. If you're not a reggae, hardcore reggae listener, a lot of it sounds the same. And I would think that reggae people feel the same about rock and roll. No,
I'm talking about the actual lyrical content here.
Oh, the lyrical content. Well, yeah, because it's not... You know that country is very conservative. And it's not going to stray from its main topic too often.
My point is that all the sadness and tragedy and every song is about the worst possible thing happening. And it loses its weight. It loses its impact to me.
Okay, I understand.
I can't... every song is sad.
Mickey Newberry was the guy I was trying to think of. We reviewed his album on here.
I wouldn't have got that, yeah.
And that's the new type of songwriter that was coming up that was much more, that taught exactly what we're speaking of. They were expanded the range of what they were talking about in Nashville and in country music from just I'm at the bar and I'm drinking my blues away. These songs that from Kris Kristofferson and Mickey Newberry and
about real things and feelings and
were
stuff.
Were about real things and complicated things.
Stuff that people go through rather than... Just losing your gal and drinking.
Yes, exactly. And you can even hear it on the last song. I was very surprised that Silent Homecoming was an anti-Vietnam song because in very conservative country music in 1970, from what I understand, I wasn't around. I was around, but I wasn't around. If you know, we were around, but we weren't around. You
supported the troops, damn it. And that meant supporting the war.
In the South, and in especially in country music, you supported the war. So for them to write, and they must have wrote it because it's Ringo and, you know, the counterculture, and they wrote an anti-Vietnam song, an anti-war song, which is very not country.
I would like Glenn someone Campbell, wrote it and thought, I got to put this away, no one can do it. And wait, Ringo, wait, he might be the outlet for this song.
right, yeah. And, you know, even Glenn Campbell, who had Galveston, which everybody thought was an anti-Vietnam song, Glenn was very pro-Vietnam because he was very conservative at the time. And so even Glenn Campbell, who I just think is like on the monument of country music along with like Johnny Cash and his people, he was very conservative. So I found it very risky. But again, they're not really, they are going after the country audience, but again, they're mostly going after the Beatle audience. So
yeah, and that's the thing about the sales. This would have caught a lot of people off guard.
This is not going to sell. It's more of a, like his first album, it's more like a labor of love. I want to do this album. I'm a Beatle and I can't.
A thing I couldn't do back when I was with the Beatles, but I can do it now.
Exactly. And I can do whole albums worth. And I'm thinking he's very happy
he did this album. Yeah, I do think he enjoyed doing this. And that kind of shows through.
Do you have anything more you wanted to say?
No, I think that's about it. I liked the familiarity of Ringo and some of the songs, but the old country is not my style of music, and I got a tough time liking it. There.
I understand. We've reviewed some old country records, like old-time country records on here, and you've always been very charitable. In all honesty, you've been very good about it. Like, you haven't really dished on... Like, we reviewed Ray Price, who can be very syrupy. I really love that album. And you thought it was a good album, too. I would have never guessed it, because you have been very charitable about the old-time country records
we've reviewed. It does make a difference when you have a singer-songwriter who's been doing the singing-songwriting for a long time.
I agree.
Ringo didn't write any of these, and as a singer, when I was singing in a couple of bands in the past, I had the opportunity to sing one or two songs.
That they told you to sing.
Yes. If you're only singing one or two songs and the other guys are singing like the other 15 or 20 or 40, you're never going to get good at it because you're only practicing once a night, which is not enough time to even warm up to find out what you sound like.
And when you say, oh, I like to sing this song, well, you don't sing that song well, but I haven't sang it yet, still.
I'm going to sing it instead. I should have turfed those guys out a long time ago.
You see this one? Remember that song we didn't want to do? Well, you sing that one.
Ringo is, he's not a professional long time singer. He's a guy who sings more for fun. It is his fun that's his selling point.
It is his fun.
That's his selling
point. But these aren't
fun
songs, most of them. You know, that's, no, but I understand what you mean.
The he is enjoying
he's
doing
for the love
them,
of
yes.
It's more the journey of actually getting to sing these songs that he was probably wanted to sing since he was a kid.
I know,
country
yeah.
songs. You know?
I know he's enjoying doing this when he's doing
oh,
it.
Oh, yeah.
He's having fun.
There's no doubt about that. I agree with you on some points. I disagree with you on some points. Again, no Beatle album is straightforward. It's so funny, but there is no Beatle album where you can not have conflicting type of
some like it, some don't.
Songwriting. But we have to talk about the scene. No, but we also have to talk about this. It's funny how no Beatle album is just cut and dried. It's just not. Sometimes it can be aggravating because sometimes you just want to have a short show and just say, you know what, we both liked it and it just rocked a lot or whatever. But every Beatle album seems to be extremely complicated. And this one is too, to a degree. I disagree. I actually think that within the parameters of what they of the type of songwriting that is needed, I find these really good songs, most of them. I like the slow country bluesy songs. I like those late night songs. I really do. I like them a lot more than I like up-tempo old-time country songs.
You are better qualified to judge them.
I don't know, because your opinion is just because your opinion is opposite doesn't mean it isn't as valid as mine.
There's sometimes I can't get past certain things to.
But that it's also a valid point, though. You know what I mean? Like when I was telling you about the reviewer who couldn't get past the religious aspects of every George Harrison album. That's why he gave it terrible reviews. As much as I dislike that. It is his point of view, and it is, as much as I dislike it, as valid as mine or your review, because that's his point of view. I don't like religious lyrics, so I don't like the album.
Yeah, and you can understand that, too, if it's explained, as far
if
as just saying,
explained.
I don't like it.
You explained it. It's just as valid as me saying, oh, but I like these songs. Why is mine more valid about this album just because I like those type of songs? It's not. It's not any more valid.
It's taste.
It's just taste.
Bloody taste.
But I will tell you that I do like, I mean, no bones about in any type of music. I like the midnight type of songs where you're sitting around lamenting about a lost love or somebody dying or
tragic whatever. Mistake you've made in your life.
The tragic mistakes that you can't go back on. Those songs really get to me. So, and I like that they did all new songs. I think it was a smart decision because I think trying to do country standards with Ringo's voice would have been disastrous because they definitely would have been inferior. And then everybody would have said, oh, he didn't do that as well as this guy. Oh, he didn't do it as well as George Jones.
These are not
or Marty Robbins.
Compared to other people doing these songs.
Exactly. That's why the idea of doing original songs is great. And the idea that they got these 12 songs right away, this album's done very fast. They made this decision to do this album in June, and they were recording in June. So they got these songs very, very fast. I think that in my capacity, because I'm a fan of this, these types of songs, I think it's a very enjoyable album. It's so strange because one of the complicated things about this album and about his first album, Sentimental Journey, is that he picked a genre of music on both of them, which is pop standards on Sentimental Journey and country songs that require stylistic singing. And what I mean by that is that you got to sing really fucking good. You know, there is no room for error in either singing standards or in singing country music. Country music may be musically a simple type of music, but to sing it is not a simple thing. It is, in fact, one of the hardest things in popular music to do. So he does. As soon as I put on Buku of Blues, I'm going, oh, it's so flat through this whole song, because I may not notice it on a pop rock record. Like Oh My My or You're 16. Oh, Ringo sings really good. But, oh, every syllable is so important in a slow country song. You don't notice it in $15 Draw because it's not slow, it's fast. You don't notice it.
Yeah. Boom, boom,
boom. Loser's Lounge, you don't notice
like it. Like I say, when he hits some of those long notes, that's where he goes off. And some of the lines were the shorter notes. He sounds fine. He sounds like really good.
But he's digging his own grave because he's picking not only country music, but he's picking slow country songs, which totally rely on the power of the vocalist.
Yeah.
And that hurts this album. But you can also hear the great playing on this album, even though it's not overdone, as you know, because they can't, except for Jerry Reed, who just...
Occasionally you get a solo here and there that's really wow. Right.
But usually they are 2-3 minute songs, and when Ringo's done finishing, then that song's over. That's the way country music is.
Yep.
But yes, more than any other album other than his first, these first two albums, his singing is not suitable. And what I mean is almost what you were saying is that, yeah, it's okay because it's Ringo, but if you're being very critical, you're saying that's not good enough for an album.
If
you're a guy walking in off the street and saying, I got 12 songs, I just wrote these 12 songs and I want to record them, and then he sang them just like this, they'd say, thank you very much, but in a million years.
We're going with Mr. Savalas.
Not in a million years would you get to record this album. And the only reason he got to record this album was because he was a Beatle. There's nothing wrong with that. You earn your dues. My God, being in the Beatles, not only for the length of time they were in it, 1970, but you have to always be a Beatle until you die.
You know, it's weird. No one's pressuring Ringo to do like a particular type of album, but Paul with Wildlife doesn't sell, and the record company's breathing down his back.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
That's hypocrisy. That's hypocrisy at its best. That's the hypocrisy you see throughout the Beatles' career. Solo up from 1970 onwards, the hypocrisy of Ringo can get away with things but
Paul's held under like a microscope, yeah.
And John is held under a microscope, yes. And oh, and Yoko's just bringing him down, and yet,
and that, the fact that the you know the record company people feel like should interfere and try and change things, like come on,
oh yeah, and make a double album from Red Rose Speedway into a single album, and
but you, yeah.
something that they would never be talk about if it was Ringo, and yeah, there's a double standard for sure. But there is a likability in Ringo, an extreme likability, which makes the album likable. And first of all, I want to say that I don't know if Ringo took lessons when, in that break between this album and his Ringo album, which was 3 years later, but I've never been unhappy with his vocals since the Ringo album till today. Only his first two albums did I think that he was so inadequate that I wouldn't have even given him a contract to make those albums.
I'll give you my theory on that is like what I was saying, where when he was in the Beatles, he was not the main singer. He was a one song an album guy.
Right.
And he never really get good doing that. But then after the Beatles, he was singing a whole lot more. And he took a pretty good voice, an okay voice, and turned it into a really good voice.
I agree. I don't know what he did, but he actually, by 1973, had a really good voice.
I think it was just more singing.
I think it was just more singing. I think it was more working on it. I think this was too soon after the Beatles to try this type of singing. I also think that...
Yeah, granted... Oh, sorry.
No, I just wanted to say that I never disliked anything he sang. And in fact, he sang a very difficult song. He sang John's Goodnight. As we all know, as the last song off the White Album, that would be a standard. That's not written as a standard. It's a pop. But I've always thought that he sang the hell out of that song. Now, he didn't have to do much, but he was never off key, and they must have done it like 100 times probably, and took the little parts off it. But I always thought. Maybe that's why. With the Beatles, you can take your time. And the Ringo, take however long, and we'll cut it into, because George Martin, you can just cut lines into it and stuff. And here is basically the band's playing, and that's it. You know, and you sing along with it.
Yep.
And that's how it goes. And I've never, like I said, other than Sentimental Journey, I've never noticed how inadequate the singing was for the standard that should be there. As it is on this album and Sentimental Journey. This album should not. I like the songs. But singing-wise, nobody except a Beatle or a big name would be able to release an album like this. And that's just a fact. That's not really a criticism. Because Ringo would eventually turn into a really fine singer, as far as I'm concerned.
Like, as much as I can be critical of this one, once again, this is after the Beatles. This is a stepping stone to what Ringo is going to do. So
yes.
It's a thing he had to
and
do.
And he got it out of the way. Yes, he got his country album out of the way. One of the most difficult things to sing. And I wish he would have sang this in like 1977. I think he would have done much better. Much better.
A stronger, more confident voice would have really...
But I found it extremely likable. I actually, I can imagine everybody going, I know it's out of tune and it's all flat, but... I like it because it's Ringo. Like you said, he's got that charm.
You know, I didn't find it to be... I just found there were occasional parts where he needed strength and didn't have it. Most of the rest of it, I thought his singing was fine.
I agree. I may be too enjoyable. Harsh, but I'm being harsh in that I'm saying for the standards of country music...
Oh, yeah.
Especially slow country music.
What is the one that Duetti did there?
I wouldn't have you any other way.
Yeah.
And then he really sounds terrible because she sings so nice.
Yes. That's what I wrote down was voices actually contrasted.
Yes. You could actually hear a good singer in Ringo at the time. And it was like, woo.
Okay.
And you get these kind of moments. You were talking about this, but you get those kind of moments where you go, ooh, like he hits a note and it's really flat and you go, ooh. But then it's like, it's Ringo. It's fun.
Yeah. But then, the next two lines he's singing, you think you're listening to the Beatles again.
Yes.
Yeah.
I agree with you on that. I just wanted to make that point that it's a hard thing to sing, and I'm sound like I'm being bitchy, but I'm not when I say nobody would get to make this album singing like that. Mm-hmm. But it's just a fact.
It's true.
Yeah. No. But because it's not only because it's Ringo and he's a Beatle, but also because he's so damn likable.
He's so likable
that he can sell these songs even if it's out of tune.
Plus, he got a lot of talent playing on this record, and yes, that a lot of talent also carries some weight.
I must say, Ringo does play on one or two songs on this, on the drums. You can hear him, especially on the two bonus tracks, Nashville Jam and Coochie Coo, kind of like at the end of the sessions, plays some killer drums. DJ Fontana, who plays drums on this, a couple of songs on this album, is one of the greatest drummers of all time. He was Elvis's drummer when Elvis started out, and he played on Hound Dog and Jailhouse Rock, and he is acknowledged as one of the greatest drummers of all time. He said that Ringo had the greatest tempo, and I'm almost quoting here, he said that Ringo had the greatest tempo that I've ever heard. He can play at a tempo and not lose it, never go off time, never lose it. And he says, I have never heard that from him, anybody. And I've been around, buddy. I've heard a lot of people. And that just tells you how much of these Nashville people thought of Ringo, not as a guy, but also as a musician. We always go back to this, Ringo as a drummer. Ringo is one of the greatest drummers in the world. And I can tell you, when the two songs, you don't have to know that Ringo plays the drums on those two songs. He kicks the shit out of those drums. He plays these difficult parts on this very jammy song. He goes, and then he goes back into tempo. People think you got to hit the drums hard and be like Keith Moon-like. You don't have to do that all the time. Sometimes you can play extremely difficult parts without being flashy.
Yep. When I was in college, one of the things, the first mistakes that a lot of drummers, beginning drummers, would make is they could be fine playing the actual tempo, but then come one phrase to another when they had to do a fill, that's when they'd lose their time. Ringo does not lose time.
Ringo does not lose time. By far, I'll never forget when I don't know if I showed Rob this, the video of the guy who was defending Ringo, and he made a YouTube video. And he was showing even one of his simple songs. I can't remember what it was. If it was Act Naturally, where he had to sing and he had to play. And he says, can you listen to this? I'm a drummer who's played for like 40 years and he never misses it. And he's playing and he's singing. And then he tried it and he says, I can't do it. I'm sorry, maybe I could do it if I practiced for 2 weeks on just on that, and I could probably get it. But he probably was presented with this song and did it. Anybody who says that Ringo is not one of the greatest drummers in the world, first of all, is not a drummer. And second of all, is a jealous drummer.
Like that Pete Best.
he amazes me.
This illustrates that point where I was saying, he's not a singer who's done a lot of singing, and it shows in his singing. He's a drummer who's been drumming since like Hamburg in the late 50s. Yeah. And solidly, consistently professional musician for...
with a band for like 12 years before this. Yeah.
And in doing that for that long, it really shows.
It shows.
It's the amount of time that you get to put into a thing which really... I can call it practice. It's just doing it a lot, yeah.
Just doing a lot and getting better at it. And I still say, I said it on one of our very earliest shows, and I still say it, Abbey Road is the greatest drumming album I've ever heard. And you may say, Abbey Road, you listen. Holy fuck. Does he come up with inventive
imagination
parts to sometimes simple rock songs, sometimes not so simple rock songs? Even he admits, I was in a groove, man, like 68 to 70. I was in a fucking groove, Ringo said. And you can tell it. He's almost like he's in such a zone that he could not come up with something bad if he tried.
Yeah.
And when you hear Abbey Road, every time I hear it, I'm both stunned by the musicianship of all four of them, to be honest with you. Paul's bass playing like something, like it's almost like a lead instrument through the whole album. And John's... rhythm guitar playing like on I Want You, She's So Heavy, and George's unbelievable lead guitar, like all through that album. Yet it's such a compact band album, right? The one guy that shines through on that album on almost every song is Ringo. He plays basic 3-minute, 4-minute rock songs like has never been played before. Inventing things that have never even been thought of yet.
Yeah, that's what the Beatles did best in the late 60s.
They did.
We're going to invent it, and you guys can do it like us.
We got to give a rating here. I didn't think that we had one of the longest shows ever, but it's just, we just, Beatles albums are complicated, man.
Yeah. I got like 2/3 of a page of notes on this one, so. Which I think I got to all of them.
So what's your rating on this?
Personal rating is a 3.
Hey, that's not bad. I give it 3.5. I really like this album. And
its good points did outweigh its bad points, but once again, this is the one where I cannot get past the.
You know what? Style. If there's one thing that is true about our ratings, is that I don't know about me. I don't know. You could talk about that, but I know when I hear your ratings, you're very tough to give high ratings to. And you're very tough to give low ratings to.
You know what I mean?
You don't like to
give... 2 is the lowest I've gone.
Yeah, you don't like to give to anything too much. But you especially don't like... You can praise... Just like we did last week with Living in the Material World. I thought you were going to give it wow, you're talking about this album so good. And you gave it 3.5. And I'm not saying that's wrong. All I'm saying is... because when I think about it, it's like, yeah, it kind of did say about 3.5 stars worth of stuff. It's just that I like the way you... rate things because very centered.
Yeah.
You don't get drawn too much to, I'm pissed off with this record, or this record made me dance around the house 6,000 times.
And I'm trying to make it a personal rating rather than a rating of what I think the others would.
Because I think personally that this, just from my opinion,
which you enjoy it, therefore.
No, but I'm thinking of you. I think that this is a 3-star record for you. And I thought that you were going to give it 2 because you were criticizing it. But you gave it what I thought you would give it as far as...
No.
How does you would probably like it?
Ringo is like Arnold Schwarzenegger. Not going to win any Oscars, but we'd love him.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And that's kind of why I thought you'd give it... You'd be harsh on the album because it's not your genre. But I always thought you'd give it 3 and you did. I think you rate really well.
Not my genre.
I just want to say that.
It was put together quickly by musicians who were assembled quickly. I mean, the Muddy Waters album where they recorded in 3 days, completely different because they've been playing together for years.
Right. See, you put all that... I mean, we both put all that into account when we do our ratings, but I find you to be much more level-headed. Sometimes I can get really pissed off at something and just slam it, not only verbally, but in my ratings. But I can also love an album to... I could give it 8 out of 5. And I like... If anybody should listen to the ratings, I think you should listen even more to Rob's, because Rob is very level-headed. And I like that, because then you know when he gives us something 4.5 and 5, he really loves it. So I gave it 3.5. Like I said, I don't know if I said it or not, but I gave it 3.5. I thought it was a very good album. Almost as good an album that Ringo could do with his limited voice and country music. And yeah.
It's the Ringo and the having fun doing it.
Yeah.
That shows up on the album.
And you know what? Even though this is, again, one of our longest shows ever, and I took out things, as I do every week, I always enjoy these Beatle themes because they're constantly, what's the word? Fascinating.
Beatles are fun. And they Beatles got so much history recorded.
There is so much to talk about. Every episode has been an hour and 20 minutes. We're going on an hour and 23 right now.
Okay, let's get out of here.
And we got to get out of here. But everything that we talk about when it comes to the Beatles, when we do this every year, is fascinating. And it's never simple. The Beatles are not a simple band to talk about or review. Anyways, that's our show for this week. Next week, we will not be putting up one up on the internet. We will be working, but we will not be putting a show up on the internet. You will hear from us in 2 weeks when we do our In Memoriam theme of recently passed away musicians. And on that note, everybody get your Beatle wigs on and your Beatle boots and
Happy Beatles Day!
Happy, well, okay, now you ruined the whole thing. So
that's why I don't say goodbye.
You know, that's why you talk, is except for the reviews, as little as possible, because you just seem to wreck everybody's
happy Beatles.
Oh my God, we're way over time. Oh, I thought we'd never be this over time ever again. So everybody, please take care and stay safe. Let me tell you who I am.
Who you might be if you are not me. Why doesn't that make sense?